طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that it is broadcast every week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We are getting a lot of information about the funding of election candidates now that the primary election season is winding down and financial reports are filed. Because of the urgency of this election, unprecedented amounts of money are being poured into the primary process, much of it dark money that comes with a cost. One of the major sources of candidate money is the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC, which is pouring huge amounts of funding into candidates based on only one issue, total support of Israel. It is supporting, among others, proven insurrectionists, white supremacists, MAGA members, if they are willing to pledge allegiance to Israel. There are no other requirements. If you are a candidate running against a critic of Israel like Rashid Tlaib or Ilhan Omar, expect boatloads of funding to support your campaign. Today we hear a forum focusing on an analysis of the actual funding of several primaries which have just taken place, and the strategies used to defeat so-called enemies of Israel, of which there is a growing number. Sponsored by the Foundation for Middle East Peace, the forum features Rania Batres, Laura Friedman, and Dr. Youssef Munayer. The forum begins with introductions by the moderator, University of Arizona Professor Dr. Maha Nasser.
Hello and welcome. I am Maha Nasser, resident non-resident fellow with the Foundation for Middle East Peace and associate professor in the School of Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Arizona. Today is August 30th, 2022. Welcome to our webinar, Israel-Palestine and Takeaways from the 2022 Democratic Party Primaries. Begin. During the 2022 Democratic Party primaries, Israel-aligned funders invested tens of millions of dollars to defeat progressive candidates who, as part of a broader rights-based democratic agenda, vocally supported Palestinian rights. So how does Israel-Palestine show up in Democratic Party politics today? How deep is the embrace of Palestinian rights among progressive candidates and in the grassroots? What has the pushback from Israel-aligned funders from both parties looked like, and how may it manifest in the future? And what does all of this mean for progressive organizing and candidates in the future? To discuss these questions and more, I'm delighted to be here today with Rania Batres. Rania is founder and president of Batres & Associates, a strategic policy and public relations firm specializing in making the progressive dream a reality. Rania has worked as a Democratic operative for nearly 20 years, and she served as deputy campaign manager for Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential run. This campaign cycle, she has advised several progressive candidates, so she's witnessing these developments on the ground in real time. We're also joined by Laura Friedman. Laura is president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace and a leading authority on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with particular expertise on the role of the, with particular expertise on the role of the U.S. Congress. Laura's Twitter threads have been must-reads in tracking primary races across the country, and she's been closely following the spending that is aimed at defeating progressive candidates. And last but not least, we're joined by Dr. Yusuf Mnayir. Yusuf is non-resident fellow at the Arab Center Washington and a leading expert on the Arab-Israeli conflict. His analysis pieces have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Boston Globe, The Nation, and elsewhere. Yusuf's latest piece in The Nation is titled, Why Can't AIPAC Defend Israel?, which he'll be discussing with us today. My colleagues will also be posting a link to that article in the chat. Speakers' bios, full bios, are available on the FNF website. So let's go ahead and get started. Rania, we'll start with you. You spent years as a Democratic operative, and then you joined Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign as Iowa Communications Director, National Director of Surrogates, and Deputy Campaign Manager. What was different about Sanders' 2016 run as compared to previous Democratic campaigns? How did his run open up space for progressive candidates to talk more openly about Palestine and the Israeli occupation?
Thank you so much, Maha, and thank you for having me here today. It's such a fantastic question because I have spent over, it's 22 years in this kind of political world, if you will. And I will have to say that that 2016 cycle, starting in 2015, of course, was unlike any other cycle I had ever been a part of, where, you know, Senator Sanders really just opened these doors. He kind of kicked them wide open, if we're being really honest, in ways that I'd never experienced before, because it was like the third rail. If you touch this, oh my gosh, everything's over, and we can't have these conversations, and the conflation of you know, at that time, going after somebody like Netanyahu, for example, or what the Israeli government was doing was immediately called anti-Semitic. And he really just, like I said, just kind of kicked the door open and allowed for those conversations and kind of said, like, status quo be damned, we're having these conversations, and come at me. I'm a Jewish man, come at me if you must. But he really opened that door wide, and I'm still very grateful for it, because I think it's led to a lot of the conversations that we're having even today, as we're sort of continuing these conversations cycle in and cycle out since that 2015-16 primary. We are seeing many more people who are willing to put themselves out there in a way that was previously almost unheard of. I mean, it was a taboo, if I can say that. I feel like that's not the right word, but you know, it was just something that people didn't even want to touch and were afraid of. I remember cycles not long before 2015 where I was begging candidates not to fall for the sort of typical AIPAC, you have to sign this letter, you have to fill out this form, you have to send us a paper. And being oftentimes the only person in the room saying, what, why are we beholden in this way to this organization at that time, especially, said, oh, we don't get involved in electoral politics. That's not what we do. Of course, we all know that's not true. But anyway, all of that to say, I think Bernie really opened a door for all of us to have more open dialogue, more honest dialogue about what's happening in Israel and with Palestinians specifically.
Great. Thank you for that. And I think it also opened the door for progressive candidates running who ran in 2018. And we saw some of those changes happening then. And so Yusuf, turning to you, in 2018, we saw the quote unquote squad coming to Congress. And so these are progressive women of color, including Representative Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, Representative Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York. So all of them ran in 2018, expressing more vocal support for Palestinian rights as part of their overall progressive, social justice-oriented agenda. Can you please talk to us about the 28 midterms and the months after that election? How did mainstream Democrats and others respond to the squad's outspokenness on Palestine?
Yeah, thank you for that, Maha. I think when we think about the 2018 midterm elections, it's important to sort of remember the bigger political context in which they took place. These midterms were, in the middle of the Trump presidency, in the middle of the Trump term. And here you had this unprecedented candidate that became president in 2016, rode a wave of really extremist white nationalist sort of politics into the Oval Office, and represented a brand of conservatism that wanted to maintain nativist white male dominance, white male Christian dominance. And part of the response in 2018 was the emergence of a number of outspoken, powerful women of color who came from, different backgrounds, including immigrant backgrounds, refugee backgrounds. It's important to remember Trump began his first weeks in office with bans on Muslim refugees and so on. So the election of these members of Congress was, I think, an important rejection of the politics of Trumpism, and in part a response to that, and also one of the reasons why their outspokenness on Palestine was so powerful, because it was also embedded in that overall rejection and response, right, to this white nationalist politics, to this ethno-nationalist nativist and racist movement that had put Donald Trump in the White House. So I think that's important to keep in mind about that moment and how remarkable it really was. And when we think about the first few weeks and months after the new members of Congress who were elected in 2018 were sworn in, right, in 2019. There are a couple of things that sort of stand out, in terms of how others in their party saw them and also how Republicans saw them, I think, as an opportunity, as a political opportunity. For example, Representative Tlaib's comment around impeaching Donald Trump was one that brought a lot of negative attention to her, put her into sort of the spotlight immediately, put her into some difficulty with Democratic leadership. But she was absolutely right about what Democrats were going to end up doing. In fact, they did it twice, right, when it came to impeaching Donald Trump. And so she was a visionary in many ways, even though the establishment was not necessarily prepared at the moment to stand behind what she was saying. And similarly, I think with Representative Omar, there was the so-called anti-Semitism controversy. I say so-called because I think it was manufactured in many ways, precisely to try to delegitimize her as a voice for the important things that she was standing for. And we saw the way that, unfortunately, the Democratic establishment not only failed to stand beside her as she was being pummeled by the right, but participated in the pylon, sadly. And one of the people, one of the leading voices in that, of course, was former Representative Elliot Engel. Perhaps there's some poetic justice in that. I think it's also important to remember that, they came with these strong progressive ideas at the moment, talking about, the importance of a $15 minimum wage, the importance of canceling student debt, and the kinds of, strong progressive policies that at the end of the day have pushed the current administration in a direction that is being increasingly welcomed by voters and really reflects where a lot of people in the Democratic Party are. So in a number of different ways, I think they were visionaries. They were ahead of where the establishment was prepared to go. There was, of course, a suspicion around them from mainstream Democrats, establishment Democrats, in part because of a bigger suspicion around Bernie-cratism in general. And for Democrats who were closer to corporate interests, this kind of politics represented a threat, not just to, the policies that they supported, but also their personal political interests and supporters. That was a huge source of tension. I'll just say a word about what Republicans wanted to use them for, because I think that's important too. Republicans saw an opportunity here to divide Democrats by using Israel as a political football. We saw this going into 2019 with the showdown over the reconciliation budget and the ways in which legislation around anti-BDS laws were trying to get crammed in there at the last minute, and the way that they were brought right back to the top of the agenda at the beginning of 2019. We saw it in all the rhetoric around, the attacks on Representative Omar and others for their positions supporting Palestinians. And it also allowed Republicans to attempt whataboutery as a cover for anti-Semitism within their own ranks, which, of course, as we know, during the Trump era, really came to the fore. And so this was something that was instrumentalized by Republicans there. And finally, and I think perhaps this is also less discussed but important, is it allowed mainstream Republicans an opportunity to train their fire against representatives that American white nationalists hate as a form of red meat towards a base that they relied on but wanted to keep a certain distance from. But it allowed them to share a common target with the most extreme elements of their party, who opposed seeing strong women voices, immigrants in power, diversity in Congress altogether. And so they were attacked on those grounds and for those reasons as well.
Great, thank you for that. So we're seeing a direct line then from Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign to the election of these progressive women of color, both of which are happening sort of on the eve of the Trump era and then in the Trump era. So Laura, let's turn it to you and bring it more, sort of through the 2018 midterm to the present. So Israel-aligned groups have been spending money on political campaigns for decades, but it used to be something that wasn't discussed openly. Can you please talk to us about the history of Israel-aligned campaign funding and how it's worked in previous campaign cycles, and then also maybe how it started to be used post-2018 with the rise of both the white nationalist sort of movement under Trump, as well as the rise of these progressive movements as well?
Thanks. That's a great question. I think actually Rania and Yusuf have laid the groundwork really well, and I'll try not to repeat them too much. They covered a lot. I think an interesting place to start is what Yusuf mentioned, which is the Ilhan Omar kerfuffle around the phrase all about the Benjamins, which I have to say for anyone who's worked in politics and electoral politics, anyone who's worked with Congress, was just surreal. The idea that that election funding, it does not play a role in Congress, pro-Israel election funding, it's absurd. And it's absurd if you've sat in an office where you're talking about, whether they will or won't sign the AIPAC letter, and a staffer says, if we don't sign the letter, my boss is going to get 5 calls from the top AIPAC affiliated funders in the district. And, AIPAC has always done this sort of with a wink and a nod because they're not a PAC. They never were previously in the political action committee sense. They love to score points when people would call them a PAC. It obviously proves that you're ignorant and biased because they're not. They were actually a public affairs committee, PAC. But the reality is they were closely linked with groups like NORPAC, which were PACs. The firewall between the groups that actually funded and the leadership of AIPAC was very, very thin. And we actually got to see how thin that was even in prior to AIPAC actually becoming a PAC, when you can go back and look at some of the research around the Democratic majority for Israel, which was when AIPAC aligned leaders wanted to start actually engaging more openly in funding. We had a group called Democratic Majority for Israel created, the argument being that this would be how real Democrats feel, and clearly a spinoff of AIPAC in terms of its leadership, but also in terms of its funding. And there, this has been written about in numerous cases. But, the funding was always an issue. And this is to suggest that it wasn't is either ignorant or deeply cynical in sense of using it for political purposes. In terms of tracking the arc of more public engagement, we've talked about, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. I actually would like to focus for a moment on what was in some ways the biggest election of that cycle for the pro-Israel focused side, which was Ocasio-Cortez unseating Joseph Crowley, who was, you know, an earnest supporter of Israel, you know, not a Jewish member, but he was one of the great standard bearers of a mainstream AIPAC-backed Israel position in Congress. And the fact that he was upset was a shock to the system. And the fact that he was upset by a young Latino woman, and then that became the birth of an era of, as Yusuf said, some of the most, you know, the red meat for some people in the right. You know, these are women, they're young, they're brown, they're black, they're Muslim. They stand together in solidarity on a range of issues. They are values focused. You can't, you know, you can't sort of, you know, look at who's, you know, donating to them to see where they're going to go. They support what they say their values are. I think was a real wake up call. And I think if you look at the next election, the next election cycle, that was where you saw DMFI come in for the first time and really try to have a different role. And they had, I mean, arguably some success. The place where I think you can sort of draw the biggest conclusions, again, looking at the through line from then to now, I would actually point at two races. One is the Elliott Engel, Jamal Bowman race. We can talk about that more. I think Rania knows more about this than I do. But, you know, it's a really fascinating race where you had a genuinely grassroots candidate massively upset a veteran mainstream incumbent who was, again, one of the standard bearers for the pro-Israel agenda in Congress. But he wasn't upset over that. This is, I mean, and this, again, is part of the through line. That race was not about Israel. Jamal Bowman didn't win because of his positions on Israel-Palestine, and Engel didn't lose because of his positions on Israel-Palestine. But you had a clear effort by DMFI to come in with money and try to save him. And they didn't succeed. And that, I think, was, again, a shock to the system. And I think it was a moment for folks who understand the role that money plays in elections to say, are we doing this right from the pro-Israel side? The other side of that, though, is the Richie Torres race, where you had elected in another New York race, a young gay African. I mean, he checks all the progressive boxes, and he's pro-Israel. And I mean, I was getting ready for this webinar today. I looked until I found this quote, and it's a quote from the head of, it was after this election cycle, it's from the head of DMFI. And she said, "Is it the Engel race or the Richie Torres race that represents the future of the Democratic Party?" And I think that is right there telling you, you know, it's sort of like there's no secret that it's telegraphing clearly what the intention was going forward, the lessons learned, you know, in terms of how races are going to be targeted and what candidates are going to be supported and what the tactic is going to be. Right. It wasn't a tactic of finding the most, you know, ardently pro-Israel, you know, AIPAC-y candidate. It was finding a candidate who appeals on all the grassroots things that people actually vote on, who's also pro-Israel, and then putting a ton of money behind them. And that really sort of gets us where we are today.
Great. Thank you for that. So Laura, sticking with you for a moment, let's turn to the current cycle. So you just talked about how funding has worked in the past and how it began to change with DMFI after the in the last election cycle or last couple of election cycles. So what's new this year in 2022, particularly in terms of the funding of campaign primaries as compared to funding in general elections? And then also, what does it mean that people and the media are talking more openly about this Israel-aligned funding now? I was quite surprised to see articles in the New York Times about the race in Michigan, the race in New York, the race and other races that talk quite openly and brazenly about the fact that there's all of this pro-Israel funding that's coming into the primaries. So can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Yeah, and the answers to those questions are deeply connected, right? It's funny, someone asked me a while ago why I was tweeting every single article that had to do with Israel in these primaries. I actually have a thread. It's, you know, many hundreds of tweets at this point. And I said, you know, I started tweeting that thread because I didn't want to be accused of just like occasionally like tweeting things that I liked or cherry picking. You know, I was trying to give myself, you know, as much to make as clear as possible. The purpose here was to follow a trend and not to sort of weigh in. And I didn't know it was going to turn into a many hundreds of tweets long thread that in retrospect, I kind of wish I had. Because it's been something of an albatross. But, you know, if in the past, in the past, it was difficult to talk about this funding because AIPAC did have this firewall. And AIPAC was very keen on arguing that anyone, again, if you get the word PAC wrong, you're clearly ignorant and an anti-Semite. You know, if you say that they are directing money, we don't direct money. How can you say that? It was hard to talk about this because it was done in this very, I want to say below the radar. These were local matters. Any candidate knew where the money was coming from, knew who they were, you could say beholden to, or at least knew who they were supported by, who they were going to give meetings to and listen to. That wasn't a secret, but to sort of the people who tried to draw or talk about this in broader terms were invariably called anti-Semites, right? Conspiracy theorists, why are you doing this? I mean, that changed in this cycle, and it changed because first of all, AIPAC decided, again, I draw a direct line between what happened in 2020 and what they saw there with things like Ocasio-Cortez and previously, and then Richie Torres and Jamal Bowman. The decision was taken, we can have impact, we should have impact. And I'm not attributing intent there. I'm believing them when they say, we decided we should do this, right? They're on the record, this is very open. So they formed a PAC, and what they've done with this PAC, and I will say for folks who are very critical of the various aspects of intervention of pro-Israel forces in our politics, they're not doing anything that's illegal. Our system is designed to work this way. People talk about for years that, the Jewish lobby this. Okay, there's nothing illegal about lobbying Congress. Our system is vulnerable to very well-organized, well-funded, groups lobbying, and lots of groups do it. Israel isn't the only one. What AIPAC did in this election, though, is figure out a vulnerability in our election process, in our primary process. And I'm, Rania has more experience in politics than I can talk about whether other groups have ever done this to the same extent. But what they realized is if you look at races where you have a safe Democratic seat, the winner of the primary is going to have that seat, that there is an opportunity there to come in heavily with heavy money and try to have an influence on the outcome of that election. And, they came in with so much money in multiple races that it's impossible not to talk about it. And there was an effort. I mean, I got pushed back a couple of times after a couple of the initial races where they did this, that it's somehow anti-Semitic to talk about it. It's like, okay, so apparently it's not anti-Semitic. It's not a problem to do it. And it's not a problem for AIPAC to literally on Twitter and in press releases tout its success in impacting elections, but it's somehow anti-Semitic to say they're doing it, which just, that doesn't work. I mean, at a certain point, you just can't believe that, particularly when AIPAC is putting out press releases. So we've hit this weird, there's been a tipping point, right? And I think the argument, we're still seeing people simultaneously arguing that it's anti-Semitic to talk about this. Why aren't you talking about other super PACs doing it? Notwithstanding the fact that AIPAC's money was the biggest money in these primaries. They spend more than AIPAC and DMFI together and a couple other sort of stealth PACs spent more than anyone else in these primaries, but somehow it's anti-Semitic to point that out. That's one argument. Another argument is it's silly to say that it had any impact. These people won or lost because of other factors, despite the fact that AIPAC is literally bragging about having had that impact. I mean, it's just nuts. And the other piece of it that is fascinating, looking at how these elections are being talked about, is, there is, if you look at the coverage of it, I think the media has been somewhat gullible or at least suggestible in framing the AIPAC wins, if you attribute these as AIPAC wins. I believe AIPAC had a significant impact. I think putting $2 million in the last part of an election, I live in DC, so I saw what happened in Maryland because it was on my TV every minute. We know what that did. It was saturated. I mean, the argument that this was about somehow a referendum on Israel-Palestine, and Yusuf can talk about this more compellingly than anybody, has seeped into the coverage of it, despite the fact that none of these elections were actually about Israel. None of these campaigns were about Israel. None of the interventions were significantly about Israel, right? So we're in a really fascinating period here where you have outside money coming in massive quantities to push races for parties that have a specific agenda that never mention and even hide that agenda when they're doing this.
Great, thank you. So let's go ahead and turn to Yusuf. So Yusuf, in your recent piece in The Nation, you make the astute point that even though Israel-aligned PACs are targeting progressive candidates for their views on Palestine, they don't actually mention Israel in their attack ads. So I was wondering if you could first talk about what some of these alleged positions are of progressive candidates that are deemed to be outside the so-called Democratic majority. And then also, why do these PACs feel they have to hide their pro-Israel agenda?
Yeah, this is something that I thought was super interesting, you know, and I'll just say I'm not an expert on political ads, but I'm sure like all of you, I've seen more than I ever care to have seen during election seasons. And so you sort of get familiar with the format and the talking points and the types of ads and so on and so forth. And so when it became clear that there was this very obvious campaign and intervention by AIPAC to have a significant impact in the Democratic primaries, I wanted to kind of understand, okay, what are the messages that they're focusing their ads on? And as I got to looking at the different ads that were out there, and they're available for everybody to see, a really interesting pattern emerges. There is no mention of Israel whatsoever in any of these ads. And, you know, there may be exceptions out there, but every ad that I've found, and I've cataloged dozens of them across many races, the pattern is the same. Not only is Israel de-emphasized, it's not even mentioned, it's avoided. And, you know, that's not necessarily a strange thing, until you understand that these are ads paid for by a single issue PAC whose single issue is Israel. And in that sense, it seems to me very unprecedented. In a world of single issue PACs, it's hard to really think of another comparable effort by a single issue PAC to spend all of this money on ads tarnishing the candidates they want to oppose and boosting those that they want to support on any issue other than the single issue that they are about. Usually, if you're a single issue PAC, whether it's on climate or on guns or the economy or whatever, your message is, hey, this candidate is bad on our issue. This is why you shouldn't support them, right? But that's not what's happening here. It's actually the exact opposite of what's happening here. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that on this issue and a wide range of other issues, especially foreign policy issues, most voters, particularly at the primary level, are simply not moved by those issues, right? People are not, the average Democratic primary voter is not voting based on foreign policy and is not voting based on, you know, one sub foreign policy issue, right? But at the same time, AIPAC is claiming that the fact that the candidates that they are supporting are winning shows that being pro-Israel is in fact good politics, as if somehow these candidates are winning because the reality is the Democratic voter base supports the positions that AIPAC takes. But if that was the case, of course, AIPAC wouldn't have to spend millions of dollars to elect these candidates and wouldn't be afraid of talking about these issues in the ads that they're spending millions of dollars on. And when one looks at the actual sort of public opinion polling on these issues, you realize exactly why AIPAC doesn't want to talk about Israel, doesn't want to mention the issue at all. And that's because the brand among Democrats, the Israel brand among Democrats, is probably irreparably tarnished. And when you look at the numbers, that becomes very clear. When for example, recent polling asking you know, Americans about their member of Congress and whether or not their member of Congress's position on Israel-Palestine reflects theirs or leans too much towards Israel or leans too much towards the Palestinians. 10 times more Democrats say that their members' position leans more towards Israel than it does than those who say that it leans towards the Palestinians. What that means is that the Democratic voter base is actually far wants to see their members move far more towards a position sympathetic to Palestinians than they are right now, which is the exact opposite, of course, of what AIPAC is claiming about where Democrats really are. So I think, you know, altogether what this tells us is that this effort is really not about, you know, a reflection of where the Democratic base is going to be, is, but rather a reflection of where AIPAC is in response to a Democratic base that has moved on. And because of that, is responding in a sort of panic to try to throw as much money as possible at a problem that they're not going to be able to solve in this way. Perhaps they can put a Band-Aid on it for some time. But these are numbers and trends that we've seen growing over time. And the reality is that unless the situation on the ground changes, more Americans are going to be increasingly critical and turning away from the kind of policies AIPAC wants to see.
Thank you for that, Yusuf. Rani, let's turn to you now and talk about a specific campaign from this cycle. So you worked on the Nida Alam race. She ran for a House seat in North Carolina's 4th District. Can you please tell us a little bit about how these issues played out in that primary? What investments were made against Nida and what was their impact?
Absolutely. Thank you again for a wonderful question and really one of my favorite people. I absolutely adore Nida. She's somebody that I work closely with. Actually, we met on the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, somebody I just really have a lot of love and respect for. And so was very, very excited when she decided to take the step and run for this open seat. David Price had been, was retiring. I'll tell you, I mean, I've worked with a lot of really incredible people. That woman worked so hard. I mean, she really, really put in the work, really put in the effort, was in the community, talking to people, showing up, really just incredible. And it's one of my biggest disappointments, I will say, her loss, for multiple reasons. One of the things, the person who won, who's the, you know, going, it's one of those districts that we were talking about before where the primary is the race that's it. She's going to, Valerie Fouché, who won the primary, is going to win the general. Valerie never showed up to anything. I mean, she didn't show up to forums. She wouldn't speak to the press. When she did speak to the press, because she was just getting pummeled about all this AIPAC and DMFI money that was coming in, and the fact that she actually didn't raise very much money at all herself. The only significant money she raised was actually bundled by AIPAC for her. So, you know, it takes buying a seat to a whole nother level when it's not only outside funding being spent, like Yusuf was talking about television, which is something I happen to do for a living as well as in political media. So they dumped millions of dollars for Valerie Fouché into ads. But then they also raised the only significant money she had on the hard side meaning the actual campaign side. And so here's somebody who's not showing up within the community, not showing up to forums. That when she did actually speak to the media, her quote was something to the effect of, we're a big tent party and we have to accept varying opinions on democracy. That was in response, and it still makes me crazy, y'all. I'm sorry, but that was in response to being called, you know, having feet held to the fire about AIPAC endorsing over 100 insurrectionist supporters. And that was her answer, varying opinions on democracy. This is a Democrat, y'all. In a million years, did we ever think we were going to be in this place? But here we are. And, you know, and then other really gross things that happened, like there was a terrible, we don't know 100% who was from, likely AIPAC or DMFI, but there was a really terrible Islamophobic push poll against Nida that was out in the community. she and her team, Valerie Cushy and her team, never condemned it, never said anything about it. So there's a lot of like really kind of nasty things as well that kind of make us all sick to our stomach. And then, you know, again, the excuses of she was saying things like, oh, all Democrats are doing this. Well, no, all Democrats are not doing this. Like AIPAC and DNFI are choosing very specific people in very specific seats to go after. And they don't actually care about the person who's running. It's about the person that's running against them. So in this case, it's NIDA. They did not want NIDA anywhere near the halls of Congress, lest she uphold justice and equity for all. And oh my goodness, we just can't have that. So, you know, it's really, really upsetting. It's one of those things where NIDA worked, like I said, very, very hard. She actually outraised everybody in the field, in the primary field, quite significantly without that AIPAC bundling help. And she did it with grassroots donors all across North Carolina and all across the country. And then here you have these entities coming in, DMFI and AIPAC, coming in and buying a seat. And by the way, this person who is now, for all intents and purposes, the congresswoman-elect for North Carolina 4 is still not showing up in her community and is still nowhere to be found. And there, you know, we've all seen what's still happening in Israel and Palestine and the occupied territories. And she said nothing, you know, she has nothing to say about anything. And this is, I think, one of the most upsetting and egregious things that happens when these seats are bought in this fashion is then all of a sudden you are pledging allegiance, not to the flag, not to the United States, not to uphold our constitution. You are pledging allegiance to AIPAC and DMFI. And I just do want to say something here because it's similar to what Yusuf was just talking about in North Carolina, all this money that was spent on behalf of Valerie who won, not a single mention of Israel, of Palestine, of any issue related to Israel and Palestine, nothing. And I have to call out the person who runs DMFI is a pollster. He does polling for a living. and so it's not an accident. It's not like, oh, we're just not going to, you know, we're not going to touch that here. It is absolutely intentional. And Mark Melman, who runs DMFI, is not a dumb person. Like, he's very, very smart. So I'm sure, I have not spoken to him about this, but my guess is he's seeing these numbers and it's not a winning strategy. Just like Yusuf was saying, it is not a winning strategy. So we're going to make it about everything else. And then immediately after that primary, AIPAC put out an email, just again, like Yusuf was saying, taking credit and look how this is a winning issue. And it's so disingenuous. And it's a lie. It's a lie. And it's really gross and upsetting. I don't know if anybody can tell, I get a little worked up over this, but it's one of those things that we can't allow that narrative to be taken a hold of and run with, because it's just not true, first of all. And it can be very disheartening to a lot of people as well. And then we also see the impacts on other campaigns, other races, other individuals who like to wrap themselves in the progressive banner, but then do this whole about face when it comes to Israel Palestine, because they've also been convinced that this is a winning issue for them. And it's just not true. It is about money and buying seats. Do we need to counter that? Absolutely. NIDA was outspent around 4-1 and just barely lost. And her campaign manager, her name is Maya Honda. She's absolutely amazing. Love that woman. She actually wrote a really compelling column right after the primary, breaking down the math of, we've seen, you know, whether it was Summer Lee, which ended in our favor, thank goodness, or other races, we've seen where candidates are able to pull it off versus not being able to pull it off. And her sort of hypothesis, if you will, is if we're outspent around 2-1, we can still make it happen. We being progressives who are truly about Palestinian justice and sovereignty. But beyond that is when it gets a little too much to overcome. So the idea is not that we have to raise dollar for dollar with them. I'm sorry to get into campaign strategy here, but you know, that's not the idea. We don't have to match them dollar for dollar, but we have to be close enough to be able to get our own message out there, get our own narrative out there in a way that competes with the dump of money that goes into the other side.
Great. Thank you for that, Rania. So Yusuf, both you and Rania have been talking about how these efforts to defeat progressive candidates don't actually mention Israel. And this is quite a contrast to earlier campaign cycles when I remember candidates who would sign these reflective statements or sort of give these boilerplate statements about how we stand unconditionally with Israel and so forth. And so we have a question from the audience that asks, to what extent have we reached a point where the usual reflexive statements of unconditional support for Israel by Democratic politicians may now become a liability rather than a prerequisite for attaining political office? Do you see that shift happening, or are we not there yet? Yusuf, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to sort of figure out where is the threshold. When have we crossed it? But I think there are some important things to sort of point to that, at least for me, have been important markers of change. Just a couple of them that I will point out is if you think about last May during the Israeli bombardment of Gaza for the umpteenth time, you saw the response or lack of response from reflexive pro-Israel stalwarts historically, like Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez, that I think anybody who's been watching this for some time would realize is very different than the way they would have responded 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So I do think that there is change there. It is becoming more of a liability. It's borne out in the numbers. The question is, how much of an impact does that actually have in electoral outcomes? And at what point does it become enough of a liability that it actually counterbalances the impact of a lot of resources that are dumped in by pro-Israel groups to shape the election outcomes the way that they want? One thing I just want to say on the influence of these super PACs in the primary campaigns. These primary campaigns are very small races. They're obviously big races to everybody who's involved with them. They're life-changing events. But when you look at the actual numbers of voters that are involved, it's not a huge number of voters. And when you think about the significant amount of resources that are coming from outside of the district, almost entirely from outside of the district in which these races are coming, taking place, sometimes from, billionaires, millionaires, and oftentimes from Republican donors as well. We need to see this not just as a threat to a pursuit of a more just American policy towards Palestine, but really a threat to democracy. And this sounds a lot like a conversation Laura and I have been having for many years around anti-BDS legislation and what it means not just for Palestinians, but people who believe in democracy and free speech and all of that. This, I think, is something similar. The impact of super PACs and primary campaigns to shape outcomes in this way is something that is not only going to be utilized by pro-Israel groups, but is going to be emulated and repeated by anyone who has the money to shape election outcomes in a way that they'd like to see. So I think for progressives, for other Democrats, even if Palestine is not your issue, this should be a huge, huge warning sign and get people thinking about what kind of rules really should be in place around spending in Democratic primaries.
You have been listening to excerpts from a forum sponsored by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on KKRN.org every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.